This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com. So I was reading my RSS feed this morning, and I came across a post in Crooked Timber reviewing Richard Reeves' Dream Hoarders. Uh-huh. So full disclosure, I've only scanned the book, but it focuses on aspects of the economy that I've thought about a lot in my own work. And I remember Elizabeth talking about it on her Twitter feed when everyone was buzzing about the book this past summer. So I thought it'd be an interesting time to bring it up. Should I go over the book or main messages? Okay, so I think the basic thrust of it, the book is when we think about inequality and privilege, a lot of us focus on the very, very wealthy and powerful, like the 1% or the billionaires. And in education, we talk a lot about elite schools, even though a very small proportion of Americans actually go there. But that's only part of the story. There's an uncomfortable aspect of the story that involves the privilege and opportunity closure that are enjoyed by people like us, well-educated people who earn, you know, relatively good money, have stable jobs. And those are the people who conduct the analyses, write the think pieces, and read economic policy think pieces. So it's everybody who's involved in the conversation. And the basic argument is that these people, this top 15, 20%, are a big part of the inequality problem. And that there are a lot of institutions and policies that keep this top, you know, fifth or so in a position of privilege. And, you know, there are examples like 529s, you know, those tax-sheltered college savings plans, or the mortgage interest deduction, or, you know, a system where local taxes pay for local schools. And what's interesting about it to me is how some of these Trump tax policies you could see as attacking that top 20% that Trump's, you know, we had Robert Francis on last week talking about how people wanted to blow up the system. And when we say blow up the system, I mean, this might be part of it. They're undoing the privileges of the top 20%. They're not really necessarily targeting those low-income people. So I thought that was quite interesting. I think that the topic is very interesting, but I know it got some blowback. Some people thought it wasn't the way to think about inequality.
Yeah, I mean, personally, right? Like this book... Okay, so I'm basing my opinion mostly on things I've read online. Mm-hmm. I haven't actually looked at the book. You know, I don't like to actually read books. I like to just form strong opinions about them based on, you know, the basis of other people's tweets.
Yeah, I think it was Moynihan who said, somebody asked him if he read a book, and he said, no, not personally.
You feel like you have, right? After you hear enough people talk about it. But, I mean, my reaction was that most of the policy recommendations that he made, or like most of the specific policies he talked about, I'm just remembering the home mortgage interest deduction, 529s were another example, that yes, I would agree these are bad policies and don't do anything for inequality overall, but I can't help but feel like saying that, hey, the real problem is the top 20% is a bait and switch. And I feel like it's a bait and switch because, you know, if you look at the top 20%, you know, yeah, they're doing okay, but like, you know, their income's going up like a small amount over the last 30 years. You know, we're talking like maybe is, you know, just it's sort of keeping up with the actual increase in GDP per capita while everybody else is just going down. I mean, this is not the group of people who are capturing all the wealth that we're producing right now. And so, you know, so I look at this and I just feel like, yeah, there's a lot of people who would like that to be the story and who have an interest in promoting that version of the story. And I don't think that's really the story, even though I agree with a lot of the specific policy changes that he wants to say.
Why can't they both be part of the story, though?
Exactly. Exactly. You know, what I mean, I this is another thing that almost made my head explode, actually, was hearing that like the next thing that's going to be on the Trump agenda is welfare reform.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? Right? Are you kidding me? Right? Do you know how many homeless people I see on any given day? Do you know, like, there are wards here, and there is one ward here in Washington, D.C., where 50% of the children who live in that ward live below the poverty line. Like, right? And we're talking welfare reform here? right? And so, and the thing is, I actually think that there are a lot of people who enjoy that, you know, that enjoy like certain, certain tax benefits, right? Who, okay, you kind of need that, you know, in order to then be able to afford your family vacation, right? And yeah, people should be able to go on vacation, but there are people who can't eat. So I think we can focus on both. Like, what are things that are necessary, right? What are things that are necessary, number one? Number two, what are things that will actually realistically lead to economic growth, right? And number three, like, why do we need to get rid of the death tax again, right? I think we should be focusing on both. And I actually do believe that, you know, there is a significant portion of people in the top, you know, 20%, right, who actually are dream hoarders, who part of what they're doing is they're trying to make sure that their kids do well. And it doesn't matter if it means they have to elbow out, you know, a few working class and low income kids to make sure that their kids do well.
I think there's two separate issues that are worth disaggregating. So on the one hand, I agree with Beth that, you know, if you look at, you know, where the incidence of growth, you know, and that basically the long tail of the curve is extending, all that sort of thing, that's all true, right? That a wildly disproportionate amount of the economic growth has gone to, you know, basically the far right tail of the distribution, not just the top quintile. So in maybe in TNT senses, that's true. But A, if you look at more robust welfare state democracies, they don't do it just by pure soak the rich, right? They basically have, you know, if they have VATs and things like that, which are not a tax that's targeted at the far right tail. They do tax intensively, basically the top half of the distribution. Mm-hmm. Second of all, even if we do assume that, you know, for TNT purposes, it is an issue of like the far right tail, not the top quintile, there's other aspects in which the top quintile really does shape inequality. Mm. And broadly speaking, I'd say TNT or tax and transfer is, because every time I use that acronym, nobody knows what it means. So tax and transfer is mostly an issue. You know, you could say that that's an issue where we really should be concerned with, you know, the super rich. And, you know, you could talk about taxing the super rich and having UBI and that sort of thing. Okay, fine. Mm. But with the top quintile, then you get into all sorts of regulatory policies that do structure inequality greatly. So, you know, where is people's money going? A lot of it goes towards housing. Mm. And the reason it goes towards housing is because there's huge barriers to building, mostly regulatory, and especially in blue states. Mm. And that's entirely an issue of the top quintile basically protecting their lifestyles by saying, we don't want traffic, you know, mm-hmm. or we don't want to have to, you know, deal with dense parking, mm-hmm. or we don't want to have more people in our school district. And so they prevent building. And you have this ridiculous thing in Berkeley of people, there's a lot that is currently zoned to allow three small houses, but it just has one small house. Mm-hmm. And the person who bought it had to go through 2 years of litigation to build three small houses, even though it's already zoned for that. They weren't trying to get it rezoned. It was already built a zone for three small houses, and the neighbors raised hell about it. And one guy was saying, if you build these extra houses, there'll be a shadow on my tomato garden and I can't grow tomatoes.
Okay.
So yeah, but you know, on top of that, you have things like, you know, how do school districts work and all that sort of thing. You have occupational licensing. So there's all these ways in which the Henrys, even if 529s and all that doesn't change the total tax incidence nearly as much as, you know, various other policies do. These are still the people for whom the regulatory state and the kind of like soft middle class welfare state is written, especially in kind, not necessarily transfer payments.
Well, Gabe, there's also a lot of market solutions that do the same thing. For example, not subsidizing tuition or not price controlling tuition. Having a $20,000 public school tuition completely is a benefit to these dream hoarders. Or, you know, that's a removal of government, you know, regulation to not be price controlling. Or for example, just the mere, the basic fact that cities locally finance their school districts instead of spending money to the a central authority who would, you know, redistribute it more progressively like they do in Canada. Like that's, these are, those are market solutions.
You realize in a lot of states, they have Robin Hood laws where the money basically all goes into a central pool at the state level and gets reallocated to school districts.
Sometimes
but that's how it works. I'm pretty sure that's how it works in California and Jersey. I'm not
in
sure
New
what
Jersey.
Yeah.
In New Jersey, it's equal spending per head, but well, what ends up, yes, but what ends up happening when it's equal, we have, for example, my district where everybody's spending, you know, 5-10 grand a school year on private, you know, a supplementary lessons, and they all have computers at home and nobody needs, you know, social, or the need for social services delivered through the school are much less. And, you know, a kid in Newark to be put on parity with a kid in our school district would need a lot more money spent on them.
Like, but now you're talking about family background characteristics. You're not, I mean, you're saying that there's a counterfactual where the redistributive state actively compensates for differences in preschool endowment. Fine. But that's a very different thing from saying, oh, there's, you know, the rich neighborhood has a better property tax base, and so it has better schools for that reason. What you're
well,
really
saying,
because in states where that, you still redistribute, it doesn't matter. It's not enough to overcome the pre-existing.
So this is how it matters, Gabe, right? Because even if you're saying that there's equal, even if you're saying that there's equal funding, the one school district has nicer buildings. One school district, you know, you can actually then get extra funding, right? You know, we, like most districts actually have extra money that if you can then, you then apply for a grant, or you go and you appeal to the school board and say you need this extra money and you get it. And that, those are the kinds of things that actually, number one, helps to increase how much money you pay your teachers, right? And number two, just by having nicer facilities and having, you know, fewer, you know, students of color and fewer poor students, right? Like also it acts as a draw for the best teachers, right? And if we're saying, and if we believe that teachers are actually the most important input in schools having to do with student outcomes, then I think that that's where we see that inequality. So you need a little bit more money in those poorer districts, just to be able to compete with trying to get teachers who.
Well, I'm not sure you'd have to, because you can have poor schools that have good assets and that have good plussing, right? So it's not just the case that the rich schools all have new construction and tons of grants, because that can happen at poor schools in poor neighborhoods too. But I think the latter part of what you're saying is actually more interesting, in that you're emphasizing the extent to which there's basically sorting. My friend Megan McArdle had this piece a couple weeks ago in Bloomberg where it got mega retweets because people just liked the title. And I amused myself greatly by doing a Twitter search for who tweeted it to see what they were saying about it. But, you know, the title of the piece was something like "Why Libertarians Were Wrong About School Vouchers Solving Problems." And so it got a bunch of, people who were basically like, you had me at why libertarians were wrong. But if they if they read the whole piece, they would see that it's actually much grimmer than that, and that what she was arguing is that the whole idea of vouchers solving problems was premised on the idea that schools can do a lot. And then if you actually look at it, you see that most of what's going on is just peer sorting, and that parents want their kids to have a desirable peer group, however they define desirable. And, mm-hmm. you know, and so you end up getting sorting in any kind of system, and the parental effects, the kind of like family background effects, and the peer group effects dwarf any type of school treatment effects. And so it's just kind of like a recipe for nothing will work.
Yeah, but not doing anything ensures that those who are already well positioned are going to be at an advantage, right? There's my main point is that the presence or the the presence of government meddling in things isn't necessarily, you know, a driver of dream hoarding, and the, our collective choice not to level the playing ground is part of what keeps dream hoarders in business.
You know, I just make one other comment about why I'm not crazy about the whole dream hoarder narrative that is going along with this book. And, you know, I think Gabriel, I actually agree with a lot of the, you know, the claims that you're making and the sort of the policy implications of the fact that there's a certain demographic that's able to capture a lot of government benefits that effectively go its own way and kind of create conditions that are favorable to its own reproduction. But I also think that there is this kind of story that goes with it where when people write these articles about this book, you know, they write about, you know, the people who, both people got Ivy League degrees and, you know, one of them works in finance and one of them is, you know, has some high powered job on Wall Street. And they're really talking about this group that they're saying, like, on the one hand, the story is, okay, this is an issue of the top 20% capturing benefits for itself. But the story that's being told is really still a story about the top couple of percent in terms of who is being blamed for this. And I think if you really look at, you know, particularly people who are in that kind of 80th to 90th percentile, that you're not seeing people who are doing exceptionally well, right? These people are going to be disproportionately in the largest, most expensive metropolitan areas. Anybody who lives in the Bay Area and is making $90,000 a year is not, you know, upper middle class. I think they're just kind of, I'm sure people are able to get by just fine, but they're not in the demographic that people are picturing when they tell the story about who dream hoarders are.
Yeah, and that's precisely because the incumbent owner, that's precisely because they don't allow more building.
Yeah, sure. No, I'm all in favor of allowing more building.
If rent was $2,500 a month, $90,000 would be
right.
Great. But, you know, a place where rent is $4,000, $4,500 a month, $90,000 feels poor.
But even with $90,000, there's a lot you can do when you're earning $95,000 in a country where, like, the median is $45,000, you know? You can put money in financial investments. Only, like, 10-15% of the country is even putting money aside in any serious way, you know?
I don't know, Joe. I mean, and not to plug somebody else, but, you know, NPR has been doing this series where they go and talk to people who make $100,000 mm-hmm. a year, and these people can barely make ends meet.
Well, I'll say at Queens College, I have students whose parents are expecting them to help with the bills,
uh-huh.
which I don't think anybody with six-figure earning parents. No, I don't feel is asking of their children. You know, there are people who have to take crappy jobs for health insurance, or, you know, their parents' house isn't big enough that they can live in the basement mm-hmm. while they do an internship. 90 grand, even in New York City, can buy you privileges that are definitely not available when you're a normal, unquote, person who makes 40, 50.
No, that's definitely true, right? But at the same time, I think part of the question is, you know, people who are making $90,000, $100,000 a year are actually struggling in places like New York, in the Bay Area, et cetera, right? So if they're kind of struggling, why are we looking solely at them as the dream hoarders and not like looking at the top, right? And also, why aren't we looking at corporations? I'm sorry, we talked about this last show, but I don't understand why we don't more effectively tax corporations and why we keep like using this same tired line of, you know, lower taxes to corporations will definitely lead to more jobs, right? I mean, I
But we already tax corporations higher than most countries.
Yeah, we tax corporations higher than most countries, but we also allow all of these loopholes so that their actual real tax rate is really not that high.
So it sounds like you support the corporate provisions of the new tax bill, which would basically lower the statutory rate and eliminate many of the deductions.
Well, but the devil's in the details, right? And since like no one seems to have actually read what's in the details, right? I don't know. I don't trust it.
Anybody want last word on this one?
Well, I guess I do have a last word. One last thing to say is that, you know, I think nobody's saying that somebody who makes $90,000 in New York City is not doing better off than somebody who makes $50,000 in New York City. And there's a lot more people who make $50,000 than who make $90,000. But, you know, but the issue that I take with this whole narrative is that it's somehow the fault of people making $90,000, that the people making $50,000 aren't doing better. And I just think that the evidence for that is pretty limited, that, you know, that if you look at the gap between what the median household income is and what the median GDP per capita is, you know, there's a lot of money that is out there that is just not going to the bottom 80% at all. And that's not because it's going to percentiles 81 through 98. It's because it's all going to the very top end.
I think it is. It's not the people who make 90,000's fault that the people who make 50 make 50, but it is the fault that it is to a large extent their fault that the rent is $4,000. And so their, you know, PPP compared to living in Houston is effectively 35.
Yeah. And kind of, I think the last thing that I would say, I mean, it's like, I'm not advocating class warfare or anything here, but you know, I'm often struck by this. Like, for example, you know, when we see, you know, like an Asian plaintiff, you know, claim discrimination by saying that affirmative action adversely affects him or her, right? Rather than just looking at, you know, like the relative test scores, et cetera, of white students and not saying, oh, hey, I'm just being discriminated against. Look at me compared to white students, right? You know, I think a lot of the complaints of, when I think about a lot of the complaints of the middle class, however they want to define themselves and how they're often left out of conversations, et cetera, I actually think, you know, a lot, like a lot of what all of us are saying actually does boil down to, hey, you know, like middle class people and lower income people actually have more, they have more to actually gain by coming together, right? To try and demand more of the top 5%, right? Then they have to gain in actually trying to game the system against each other. Why don't they do that more?
I think we'll sort it out in our special forum of contemporary sociology on Richard What's-His-Face's Dream Hoarders. We better move on.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.